Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the FCC. Please enjoy your lunch, but I'll start the proceedings. My name is Douglas Wong. I'm the Asia legal editor at Bloomberg News, and it's my honor as a member of the FCC's professional committee to host today's talk by Lord Neuberger on the third and fourth estates, judges, journalists, and open justice. A couple of quick reminders before we start. Please put your phones on silent mode if you haven't already done so. And if you weren't aware, we have two more important events this week. On Thursday, Hong Kong, two top Chinese law professors will talk about how Beijing views Hong Kong's constitutional protections. And tomorrow, Guangdong's top economic planner will tell us how the province's seaborne trade will continue to flourish, which must be a good thing for Hong Kong, I guess. Of course, as FCC members, we believe that press freedom, open justice, and the rule of law are critical to Hong Kong's prosperity. And I can think of no better person to help us think more deeply about that than today's speaker. Three simple words describe David Neuberger and have been repeated to me when I've told people we would have the pleasure of hearing from him today: an outstanding judge. His recent judgments have ranged from settling two centuries of disputes over whether bribes received by an agent are held on trust for their principal, to determining when issues turning on religious beliefs can be decided by courts. His recent public speeches, drawing on a lifetime of learning in the law, investment banking, and as a student at Oxford Chemistry, have looked at 100 years of human rights in Britain, diversity in the legal sector, and Britain's future in Europe. I'm sure you're as excited as I am to hear what he has to share with us today, so please join me in welcoming to the podium Lord Neuberger of Abbotsbury.
Thank you very much indeed. It's a great pleasure to be here today. I'm sorry to be ruining or interrupting your lunch. I'm going to talk, as I say, about judges, journalists, and open justice, and the rule of law. The rule of law is fundamental to any civilized society. And the rule of law means, at the very least, society governed by laws which are properly enacted, clearly expressed, publicly accessible, generally observed, and genuinely enforceable. Enforceability includes access to courts so that people can enforce their rights and defend themselves. Rights which are unenforceable are as bad as no rights at all. The rule of law also, of course, requires the honest, fair, and efficient, as well as the open dispensation of justice. And therefore, there's no hope for the rule of law unless we have judges who are independent, honest, fair, and competent, and who are seen to be independent, honest, fair, and competent. Now, judicial honesty, fairness, and competence can be dealt with relatively quickly. It's self-evident that if judges are dishonest, if the judiciary can be bribed or suborned, the rule of law will be fatally undermined. If judges break the law, what possible hope is there that anybody else will bother to observe it? Similarly, competence and fairness are essential requirements of a judge. An incompetent or unfair judge is almost as much of a contradiction in terms as a dishonest judge. Competence is a prerequisite for judicial office. So is fairness, which involves judges making sure that the law is applied equally and in the same way, irrespective of means, gender, age, and other characteristics. It's why justice is portrayed traditionally in Western art as blind. Judicial independence merits a little more attention. Traditionally, of course, there are three branches of the state. There's the legislature, which makes and develops the law. There's the executive, which carries out and enforces the law, the civil service and so on. And there's the judiciary, which interprets and gives effect to the law. The rule of law requires the three branches to be generally independent of each other because their functions should be distinct. Those who make the law shouldn't be involved with interpreting it or carrying it out. Those who carry out the law should not make it or interpret it. And those who interpret the law should not make it or put it into effect. Now, independence for the judiciary means that the legislature and the executive should not be able either to interfere with or influence judicial decision-making or to remove judges from office. because if you can remove judges from office, you indirectly control their decision making. Judicial independence is particularly precious. That's for two reasons. First, as Alexander Hamilton, who was one of the founding fathers who helped frame the United States Constitution, said, the judiciary is beyond comparison the weakest of the three departments of power. And he went on to say, all possible care is requisite to enable it to defend itself against attacks from the executive or the legislature. The second reason is that it's particularly important that the judicial branch is independent of the legislature and the executive because of the very functions of the judges. At least in a democratic society, the legislature is often seen to have the greatest legitimacy of the three branches of government because it's democratically elected. But that very fact means that it should respect the independence of the judiciary. Democracy isn't faultless. It can lead to tyranny of the majority, and in extreme cases, it can lead to worse. It's always worth remembering that Hitler and Mussolini both came to power as a result of a democratic vote. Politicians are frequently driven to make decisions based on expediency. That's not intended to be a criticism of politicians, it's the nature of the beast. The courts can therefore usefully act as a brake on political calculation and short-termism. The very fact that judges don't have to worry about being re-elected or losing their jobs means that they can and sometimes should make the difficult and unpopular decisions, which are understandably very difficult for politicians. Of course, this is a power which judges should exercise diffidently and cautiously. As for the executive, a judge has no more important function than to protect citizens against abuses of power of an increasingly mighty executive branch of government, whichever country one is talking about. So the last thing we need is the executive getting involved in decisions or security of tenure of the judiciary. You can see, therefore, why Hamilton went on to approve the French philosopher Montesquieu's statement that there's no liberty if the power of judging be not separated from the legislative and executive powers. So the much-used expression, separation of powers, embraces judicial independence. Now, I know that there's been some concern in some quarters in Hong Kong about the possible undermining of judicial independence in the light of the suggestion from a PRC white paper that judges administrate the special administrative region. This concern reminds me of the worry which some UK judges have about the fact that their email address ends with .gov.uk. They cry, we are not part of the government, we are the judiciary. Well, to a judge and lawyer, like many legal issues, the argument is ultimately about the meaning of a word. And as any lawyer knows, words are slippery things. I said words are slippery things, not lawyers. The word government can be properly used to mean either the executive arm of government alone or all three branches of the government, including the judiciary. And the word administration is similarly imprecise. One can say that Hong Kong used to be under British administration, which would include British judges. But one could refer in the UK to Mr. Cameron's administration, which would certainly not include judges. And it may be a somewhat cheap point, but I took the judicial oath, as did all Hong Kong judges, and the oath includes a promise to administer justice without fear or favour. I know there's also been much talk in Hong Kong about the white paper's suggestion that judges in the special administrative region should be patriotic. A judge is expected to be patriotic to the extent that he or she takes an oath of allegiance. In the United Kingdom, I took an oath to be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth II as sovereign of the country. And in Hong Kong, I took an oath to bear allegiance to the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region of the PRC. Indeed, the judges of England and Wales are called Her Majesty's judges. And the 16th century Lord Chancellor Francis Bacon, also a brilliant essayist, and some people think the writer of Shakespeare's plays, is famously reputed to have referred to the English judiciary as the lions under the throne. In light of what I've said about judicial honesty, I regret to tell you that Bacon had to resign as Lord Chancellor for accepting bribes. While I therefore wonder whether there is anything to worry about in the white paper, let me make it clear that I'm not seeking to take sides in the political argument. in the light of the separation of powers, you'll understand that that would be inappropriate for a judge. Further, I can't pretend to any expertise or knowledge which would justify me presuming to talk about the issue which is very much current at the moment, I know, about the relationship between Hong Kong and the PRC. But in principle, having said what I've said, I should add that I am no more in favor of complacency than I am in favor of alarmism. I enthusiastically subscribe to the notion that the price of liberty is eternal vigilance. Since 1996, when I became a judge, a senior cabinet minister in the UK, the Home Secretary, varied as to who it was, has from time to time made inappropriate remarks about the judges and about a judicial decision. And on each such event, the judiciary has always made it very clear, publicly, that such remarks should not have been made and are inconsistent with judicial independence. That's very sensible. Any threat to judicial independence has to be headed off at the pass. But judicial independence is not inconsistent with judicial patriotism. The way in which judges demonstrate their patriotism is by an irrevocable and undiluted commitment to the rule of law, which involves resolving disputes independently, fearlessly, honestly, fairly, and in accordance with the law, and as efficiently and openly as their capabilities and circumstances admit. But of course, it's just as important that judges are seen to be resolving disputes independently, fearlessly, honestly, fairly, and in accordance with the law, and as efficiently and openly as circumstances permit. That's what open justice is all about. Open justice is an essential feature of the rule of law. In its most basic form, it means that the court hearings take place in public and judges' decisions are available to the public. If courts sit in private, judges cease to be properly accountable for their decisions, as the public don't know what the evidence and arguments were put before the judge or why the judge reached a particular decision. Judges will start to get into bad habits if the public and the press are excluded from their courts. And even if judges resist the temptation to misbehave, how can the public have confidence in us if they don't see us at work? Sunlight, it has been said, is the best of disinfectants. It's no coincidence that in England, it was decided that evidence obtained by torture could not be given in court in the same year that a notorious secret tribunal, the Court of the Star Chamber, was abolished. Sometimes, of course, cases or aspects of cases have to be kept secret to protect children, to protect confidential information, to protect national security. But as has been emphasized time and again by judges, in such cases, secrecy should only be permitted if it is absolutely necessary, and even then it should be kept to an absolute minimum. But open justice isn't just about the courts being open to visitors to come in physically. I think there's a strong case for saying that they should be televised. That is, after all, merely the modern extension of enabling the public to enter the courts physically. Of course, concerns about intimidation of witnesses and juries and about witnesses and juries playing to the gallery have to be addressed. But that doesn't apply to appeals where there are no witnesses or any juries. In the UK, most of the Supreme Court hearings are filmed and streamed, and the Court of Appeal in the UK, or is it in London, is starting to take the same course. The O.J. Simpson trial many years ago may have been a lesson on how not to do it, but I found the filming of the Oscar Pistorius trial impressive. But it's not just trials and hearings which have to be accessible. It's also our decisions. It can be a formidable task, even for an experienced lawyer, to read through and understand a difficult Supreme Court decision of the UK running to hundreds of paragraphs with a number of conflicting or subtly differing judgments. I've previously commented on how, when reading some previous judgments, I find myself rather losing the will to live. And it's particularly disturbing when I realize that it's actually one of my own judgments that I'm reading. We judges owe it to the public, particularly in cases which are important or excite general interest, to ensure that our decision and our essential reasoning are as comprehensible and accessible as possible to the public. In such cases, there's a great deal to be said for the court providing a summary of the decision, expressed in clear and simple language. And both in the Hong Kong Court of Final Appeal and the UK Supreme Court, we routinely provide to anyone who wants it a two-page document which attempts to explain concisely and clearly the facts, issues, decisions, and reasons for every appeal we decide. Indeed, in the Supreme Court, we also give judgments orally in a televised version, which is even shorter. And of course, most members of the public, dare I say it, even most lawyers, don't get their information about court hearings and decisions from visits to the court, watching streamed hearings, reading judgments, or reading written summaries. The source of information most people get about our decisions and our judgments are from the media, from newspapers, television, radio, and now, of course, electronic media. Just about the time that the founding fathers of the United States, including Alexander Hamilton, were discussing their constitution, people were beginning to realize that there was a new source of influence coming into existence, the newspapers. Indeed, it would seem that it was literally a year before Hamilton wrote about the independence of the judiciary that the UK politician Edmund Burke first coined the expression, the fourth estate, as a reference to the press. The media, and perhaps particularly the written media, have a very important function in relation to the judiciary and the courts, and therefore to the rule of law. The media play an essential part in ensuring open justice by reporting to the public what goes on in court and what judges and juries have decided. The media also provides, of course, a vital forum for comments and discussions about such matters. Open justice involves the public and the media understanding what goes on in court and what judges have decided. But open justice also requires that there should be healthy and informed discussion about the judicial process and judicial decisions. Judicial decisions are not just simply to be handed down to an admiring and meekly receptive public and press who do not answer back. It's important that the public and the press should be able to express as well as to form views about our decisions. Indeed, if journalists cannot report on what goes on in court, and if journalists and indeed members of the public can't give their views on what goes on in court, that would undermine freedom of expression, another vital ingredient of a modern democratic society. The media, therefore, not merely have the right, but I think they have a positive obligation to report fearlessly on what goes on in court, what judges are deciding, although I have to accept that sometimes the comments are uncomfortable reading for judges. But just as judges mustn't abuse our privilege, which are accorded to us not because we're wonderful people, but because of the importance of judicial independence, so should journalists and other communicators not abuse their privileges, which they have because of the importance of freedom of expression. So inaccurate and unfair reporting of a judge's decision to make a good story is an abuse of freedom of expression. It undermines the rule of law. Now, I accept at once that one mustn't be too precious in one's definition of inaccurate or unfair in this context. Journalists reporting on a court decision are almost always bound to simplify what a judge has said. It would be impossible not to do so. But journalistic license, I accept, goes further than that. It's unrealistic not to accept that there will be a degree of exaggeration, one-sidedness, even spin in newspaper reports of some, particularly of some controversial cases. It's part of freedom of expression that newspapers and other media should be able to criticize a judgment or to campaign for a change in the law. But persuasion should always be based on accuracy and truth rather than misrepresenting what was said or propaganda. It's one thing to disagree with a judgment and to fight to change its effect. It's quite another to misstate what was said in the judgment. Truth is every bit as precious a commodity as fearlessness. Freedom of the press is an aspect, albeit a vital aspect, of freedom of expression. In the United Kingdom, at any rate, a highly contentious issue on which judges have frequently had to rule is the conflict between the rights of newspapers to report on the private lives of celebrities, footballers, models, film stars, and the like, and the right of those celebrities to maintain their privacy. A conflict which is said to be one between freedom of expression and respect for privacy. Nobody doubts that the two rights exist, and very few people would deny that some cases throw up real tensions between the two rights and are hard to resolve. Some people suggest that freedom of expression is such an important right that it should rarely be trumped by a privacy claim. That view is close to what is adopted in the United States, but not in Europe. I'd like to end with two thoughts on privacy and freedom of the press. First, I'd like to suggest that at least in many cases, the right to privacy is not in fact a separate right, but in truth, it's an aspect of freedom of expression. If I want to do or say something, which I'm only prepared to do or say privately, then it could be said to be an interference with my freedom of expression if I cannot do it or cannot say it because it will be reported in a newspaper. Accordingly, at least in many cases, a fight in court between a person who wishes to keep what he or she has done or said confidential and a newspaper which wishes to publish what was said is a fight between two competing claims based on freedom of expression. The other point I'd like to make arises from the consequences of the astonishing developments in IT over the past decade, the ease with which information can be transmitted and received across the world, the ease with which words and scenes can be clandestinely recorded, and the ease with which information can be misrepresented or doctored. These developments may make it inevitable that the law on privacy, indeed the law relating to communications generally, may have to be reconsidered. After all, if we keep the law in such a way as it is unrealistic or unenforceable, that itself undermines the rule of law, and laws have to change to reflect reality. There is no doubt that these technological developments give rise to enormous challenges for people involved in the law and for those involved in the media. In conclusion, judges and journalists have much in common. First, because of two fundamental principles, the rule of law and freedom of expression, we are each accorded important privileges in the interest of society as a whole. Secondly, at the present time, each of these privileges is as important as it ever was because of the need to hold the domestically increasingly mighty executive arm of government to account. Thirdly, each of these privileges carries concomitant responsibility, which we judges and journalists should never forget. Finally, with the remarkable recent developments in the electronic world, the weight of those responsibilities is greater than it ever has been. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Lord Neuberger. And with the incredible collection of legal and journalistic minds in this audience, I'm sure you're going to ask Lord Neuberger tougher questions than we did on the table. So without further ado, if I could ask anyone who has a question to raise their hand, someone will bring a microphone to you, and if you could just identify yourself before you ask the question. Thank you.
Nigel Sharman Ashurst, and I'm also a former BBC journalist. Would it be correct to say, in summary of your comments on recent developments here, that much of it has been a bit of a fuss about nothing?
I don't think I'd put it that way. I think that as a matter of language and concept, the concern about administrate and patriotic, if I can put it very shortly, in the white paper seems to me to be capable of being stigmatized as unreasonable in the sense that one can justify both words. But it would be quite wrong for me to pontificate about the political risks because, A, as I said in my talk, most of you, possibly all of you, except my wife here, knows more about it and will have more experience of it than I've done. Secondly, as a judge, it's not appropriate for me to comment on specific political issues. But so far as the general principle is concerned, all I'm saying is that the specific argument seems to me to be one to which there may be an explanation. Whether the explanation is a good one or not, because words, as I say, are slippery and can mean different things to different people, is not something which I really feel it's right for me to comment on. What I do say is that it is always right to be vigilant about protecting rights such as democratic rights, freedom of speech, independence of the judiciary, and all these other matters that are so important to us. And while I would not condone alarmism, I certainly wouldn't deprecate concern and express concern at any time about any reasonably perceived assault on these important values.
Thank you, Lord Neuberger, for your comments earlier. Just following up on what you just finished saying, not too long ago, Ensign Chan, a senior former civil servant with the government here, asked in this club openly, where is Britain? Where is Britain in helping to support us? And I wonder, even going beyond the comments you just made, whether you think Britain or the British judiciary has a moral imperative to support Hong Kong people's desires?
Hong Kong's people's desires, I'm being very lawyerish, is a pretty vague concept. I certainly, as part of the handover part agreement, as you know, the reason I'm here, is that senior judges, a number of senior judges from the UK, come and sit in the Court of Final Appeal, and I'm privileged enough to be one of them. To that extent, given that, as I've said, the judge's function is to uphold the rule of law, and that's no more important than in the Court of Final Appeal, we are playing a part in doing that. And if I felt that the independence of the judiciary in Hong Kong was being undermined, then I would either have to speak out or I would have to resign as a judge. And certainly from my perspective and what I can speak about with confidence, I can say at the moment I detect no undermining of judicial independence. Now what I can't say, because I'm not competent to say it, is whether there is any threat and how great the threat is and where it's coming from. I can only talk about the present factual position. So far as the United Kingdom government more generally is concerned, I would be acting way outside my role if I started to pontificate on what the UK government should or shouldn't do and can and can't do in relation to Hong Kong. That would be, if I'm expecting English UK politicians to keep their hands off the judiciary, which they're very good at doing, then I have to respect that by keeping my hands off their work. So whatever views I may privately have about the role of the United Kingdom, it would be inappropriate for me to go further, I think, than I have.
If I can just follow up briefly, though, it was only a few weeks ago that we had barristers and solicitors walking in the streets, essentially, to express their concerns. Do you think the British judiciary ought to be supporting them? I'm sure many of them were British, but...
Well, I think that the practicing lawyers have a greater freedom and a different sort of responsibility than serving judges. There were, I suspect, no serving Hong Kong judges included in that parade, and it would have been, I think, I don't know the details, but it's not appropriate normally for judges to get involved in that sort of activity. Don't misunderstand me, there does come a point, I would accept, where if you think of totalitarian regimes in Europe, which were still going on, indeed some might say one or two places going on today, but certainly going a lot of them going on before the fall of the Iron Curtain, I think that the judges do have a duty, and at a point comes where a judge either has to speak up or resign. But as I say, at the moment in Hong Kong, I see no present problem.
Anyone else in the audience before we take another question from up here? No? Oh, maybe the gentleman here at the front.
Hi, Lord Neuberger, Albert Wong, Council. Back to the topic of open justice. You spoke very impressively of the streaming facilities of the Supreme Court, perhaps one day televising trials. All that, one assumes, involves better judicial resources. Now, having sat, obviously, in the UK and in the Court of Final Appeal here, are our judicial resources up to it in order to be able to provide press better summaries, public better open justice, and perhaps streaming one day?
You're absolutely right in the present climate in the UK, and perhaps to a lesser extent, but I'm not sure, in Hong Kong. One has to be realistic, and the extent to which public money should be spent and public money attributable to justice or allocated to justice should be spent on filming and streaming is questionable. The Court of Appeal in England and Wales is being filmed. The proposal is that it's to be filmed, and the money will come from the press or from the media organisations. That itself can lead to problems, because at least in the Supreme Court, and I believe that's always been the case in the Supreme Court, we control the filming, and therefore we control the rights and so on. Once the press has the rights, you then have to be pretty careful about detailing what those rights entail and what control the court has. But you're absolutely right, the ideal of being able to film every court up and down the land would be very expensive. And one wonders how many channels it would require. I think on the whole, it's not for me to make up policy sort of sitting here, but I think it may be right to film hearings either at random or hearings of particular interest. The main problems with hearings of particular interest is that they will tend to involve celebrities. I mean, there was the famous case of Michael Douglas and Catherine Zeta-Jones and the wedding photographs that were published in Hello magazine illicitly, and they both gave evidence. Now, that's just the sort of hearing which the press would love to be. And the danger is that the particular hearings that the press would love to be may be in danger of being turned into circuses. That's what I thought was so interesting about the Pistorius trial. While it didn't involve quite the same degree of celebrities, Oscar Pistorius himself is obviously something of a celebrity. He chose, as was his right, not to be filmed giving evidence, but you heard his voice. But virtually everybody else was filmed. And it wasn't turned into a circus by anybody. I very much got the feeling that it was what was happening, what everyone was saying and doing, was exactly what they would have done and said if they weren't being filmed. And I'm skeptical that it makes that much difference. I think the worrying aspect comes, for instance, if juries in cases involving organized criminals, or suspected organized criminals, juries may feel threatened if they're being filmed, and you've got to protect them. And then there are certain people that certain religions where women would be very upset at having their faces shown. You have to make that sort of allowance. But I think on cost, you're absolutely right. Spending large sums of money, when at any rate in the UK the justice system is skint, is very questionable.
I have a question if no one else does, and I know our president has a question, but we would love to hear from the audience. If you go ahead, and then if there's no questions from the audience, I'll ask a question.
Thanks, Doug. On an allied question about the best use of public funds, you said at the outset in your opening remarks that one of the bedrock principles for the rule of law is access to justice. As you know well, the current UK government has quite sharply cut funds for legal aid and other ways that people who might not necessarily be able to afford the sharpest legal minds can access justice. Do you think, therefore, current UK government policy is undermining the rule of law?
It's a very interesting area, because conceptually I said that judges shouldn't get involved in government policy. But one area where I think we do have a right and a positive duty to get involved is on aspects like access to the courts. Now, you're quite right. In 1999, the government in the UK got rid of legal aid for most civil cases and introduced what I think is a very unfortunate, turned out to be a very unfortunate, way of funding litigation. In Hong Kong, you've adopted, I think, a much better route of funding civil litigation. In England, having taken a very bad turn in 1999, we're now trying to put it right in 2012 onwards. I think that, well, I've said in public, and I'll say it here again, that there is a risk in the United Kingdom that people are not getting the access to justice they should be getting, and that the government should be doing something about it. And to be fair to the government, in 2012, they started to do things which are now being
rolled out, if I dare use that expression, and I hope things will get better. But one of the troubles is that in a civil law system, in Germany and France and so on, lawyers come more cheaply than in the common law system, partly because litigation is fuller in a common law system like Hong Kong or the United Kingdom. You have full disclosure of documents, you have cross-examination, trials can last a long time. We go into matters in great detail. In the civilian law system on the continent of Europe, they tend to have cases that are much shorter. Also, lawyers earn less money on the whole in those countries, not across the piece, but acting in smaller cases. Now, we want lawyers to earn reasonably well, because if you don't pay lawyers well, the best people won't become lawyers, and one needs good lawyers. So it's a difficult exercise. My solution is really that if you've got a small case, we have to cut out a lot of the expensive work, such as disclosure of documents, detailed cross-examination, and so on. And we have to accept that what I've called, perhaps slightly unfortunately, quick and dirty justice is better than no justice at all. I've seen cases in our courts in England and Wales where the amount at stake was £10,000 and each side's costs were £200,000. And that's just ridiculous. It's not justice. Nobody in their right mind would litigate about it. So if you're going to have the ability to sue for £10,000 and the ability to defend yourself, that's about $120,000, of course, then you should adapt the system to enable it to make it economically effective. And I think the government has its role to play in legal aid. Lawyers have a role to play in terms of trying, within limits they have to make a living, to keep down the costs and produce an efficient service. And judges have a role to play in terms of ensuring that they control cases to keep costs to a minimum. And in the UK, I think we, all three of us, could do better than we've done.
Any questions from the audience? Anyone? Oh, sorry, there's someone in the back, I believe, who I can't see. I'm sorry if you've been waving your arm for a while.
It's Tony Watson. I work with Lim Advisors, a fund manager here in Hong Kong. Can you comment on the challenges of providing or operating a legal system in a place where not everyone speaks the same language, particularly, I guess, in a lot of cases, you have judges who only speak English and witnesses and or lawyers who speak a combination of some type of dialect of Chinese or no English at all, given particularly that the law is written, I guess, ultimately in English. And then a second question is, have you ever found this to get in the way of fair administration of justice? Thank you.
I think with the increasing internationalization of the world, it's become a problem generally, but clearly it's more of a problem here, potentially, than in England. I mean, in England we find that the need for interpreters and the cost of providing interpretation services has increased dramatically with asylum seekers and immigrants coming in who don't speak English. Here, the problem is more acute for two reasons. One is, as you say, there are a lot of people who don't speak English, and particularly the appeal courts, or the CFA, conducts its proceedings in English. As I understand it, the courts, Court of Appeal and High Court and District Courts conduct their cases in either language. There is a second problem, which is that, of course, a lot of the ordinances are in English and Chinese, and sometimes when there's an argument about what the ordinance means, it's a benefit to look at Chinese and English, because they are both official versions. And to someone like myself, who doesn't speak Chinese and can't read Chinese, that is undoubtedly a disadvantage. And clearly, if you have a court where some people speak Chinese and don't understand English, and some people speak English and don't understand Chinese, and the case is conducted in both, it can be a disadvantage. I think it's a fact of life. I think that if you pretend it isn't a problem, you're more likely to find that it is than if you accept it's a problem and do your best to overcome it. You're never going to be perfect, because however much you have expert translation, if someone is not fluent in both languages, that is a potential disadvantage. So the short answer is, A, yes, you've got to recognize it's a problem. B, you have to do your best to cope with it. But C, it's a problem which you're not going to get rid of completely by having good interpretation and by working on it. But I think in the case that I have had, where we had to look at the Chinese version, I'm satisfied, as satisfied as I can be, that even though I didn't speak Chinese and couldn't read Chinese, I was able to take into account properly, having been told by barristers and by my fellow judges, I could take into account the Chinese version properly. Fortunately, it confirmed my view of what the English meant. Perhaps it would have been more difficult if it hadn't.
We just have a couple more minutes, so that's one more, probably time for one more question, and I have one, but I will yield if someone in the audience has one. You're all very kind, so so Mike, so we will, all of us in this room, obviously be eternally vigilant, but I wonder, Lord Newburg, if you've any thoughts on how that other former British colony, Singapore, has been boosting its legal sector, including its plans to have an international commercial court with foreign judges. As a big fan of your comments on open justice, it saddens me to say that journalists in Singapore have access to more court documents than they do in Hong Kong. So is Hong Kong in danger of being eclipsed by Singapore in terms of its reputation as a jurisdiction for open justice and rule of law?
I can't control reputation, and it wouldn't be right for me to do so beyond saying that it's really repeating, as far as I'm concerned, in terms of the judiciary carrying on its task. I think the judges here, certainly in the Court of Final Appeal where I sit, are as independent-minded and independent in practice in reaching their decisions and taking into account arguments and deciding which cases to take, as the United Kingdom Supreme Court is. If it wasn't, I don't think I would sit there. It wouldn't be proper for me to do so. So far as Singapore's proposals are concerned, I'm aware there is a certain possible competition between Singapore and Hong Kong. My own personal loyalty, if I'm allowed to express a patriotic view, is in favour of Hong Kong. I've been a judge here. I am a judge here. I know the system. I can't say, although I've been to Singapore, I can't really talk with any authority about Singapore judicial system or court system. What I can say is that I think that it is enormously rewarding and beneficial to have judges from one jurisdiction, in my case the United Kingdom, coming to sit in a court of a different jurisdiction, Hong Kong. I believe it benefits Hong Kong, although that sounds rather arrogant. I'm not talking about myself, but generally to have fresh view, fresh experiences, a bit of fresh air, as it were, in. And it's certainly enormously beneficial for me, sitting in London in one court, day in, day out, to come over here and sit with different people, see new lawyers, new laws, and new approaches. And certainly, I would love it if the common law countries, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, maybe Singapore, actually swap judges in a way that Hong Kong has done to its benefit and to the benefit of judges such as myself who sit here. When it comes to the specific proposal about the Singapore Commercial Court, I'm aware of it, and you and I briefly discussed it over lunch. But I wouldn't feel comfortable about commenting on it specifically because I don't know enough about it.
Thank you very much, Lord Newburger, and we are at 2 o'clock, so I think we should wrap up for all of us who need to get back to work, but I'm sure you will all join me in giving a very warm round of applause to thank Lord Newburger for this fresh air he's brought us.